Hello, iterative marketers. Welcome to the Iterative Marketing Podcast, where each week we give marketers and entrepreneurs actionable ideas, techniques, and examples to improve your marketing results. If you want notes and links to the resources discussed on the show, sign up to get them emailed to you each week at iterativemarketing.net. There you'll also find the Iterative Marketing blog and our community LinkedIn group where you can share ideas and ask questions of your fellow iterative marketers. Now let's dive into the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Iterative Marketing Podcast. I'm your host, Steve Robinson, and with me, as always, is the intellectualized and edumacated Elizabeth Aaron. How are you doing today, Elizabeth?
I'm good. I think that's my favorite one yet, edumacated.
Edumacated?
Mm-hmm, I like that.
I like that word. So what have you been up to lately?
I have to admit, I have, I'm part of that cult following that's in love with the Gilmore Girls, and I finally got around to finishing the four-part series that aired on Netflix last night, and I finished it right before bed, which was not a good idea, so I had Gilmore Girl dreams all night long, which were really, really weird, so.
Okay, so explain this to me, because Kim also was super excited about this Gilmore Girls revival thing, and I don't get it.
Did you ever watch the original series?
No.
Yeah, that's what it is. I don't know. It's like the best show ever. It's this relationship between this mother and this daughter, and it's a very unique relationship, and they're very well read, and so it's a very fast paced kind of all over the place. I feel like it really accurately captures what's going on inside of a girl or a woman's head at any given point in time. I'm sure you've had this conversation with your wife where you're focused on one thing and then we're like jumping from like 15 different topics in a 2-minute period and you're just trying to keep up. That happens in the show. That's what the whole show is about. So it's fun and they eat junk food and they watch great movies and they read great books. And it's just, you want to go be friends with the Gilmore Girls.
I see. So it's just, you know, everybody can identify and want to be them. And it, yeah. Okay. I still don't think I'm going to get it, but that's okay.
I tried to get my husband to watch an episode with me, and I tried to get my sister to watch an episode, who is not really a girly girl at all. And they both looked at me like I was nuts. We made it through 5 minutes and they're like, we're done. They wouldn't even watch the whole hour long episode. So I guess it's not for everyone, but myself and my other sisters, we, you know, were texting back and forth while we were watching it. Like, can you believe this just happened? I'm not going to give anything away because that's not fair. So.
Okay. Well, if Gilmore Girls isn't for everyone, is our actual topic for today for everyone?
I think so. I'm really excited about it because what we're talking about today is tools for effective experimentation. And we've done a few different episodes on experimentation. But what I love about this is we actually dive into the specific tools that you use, because it's one thing to understand the concepts, but then when you get to actually applying them, that's not necessarily something you can do with, you know, just an Excel spreadsheet and, you know, a calculator. You need some other tools. And so we're going to get into that today.
Yeah. And it's going to be really tactical and really sort of hands-on. This is not a high level conceptual type of episode. This is a jam packed. We are down to the metal talking about how to get the most out of these tools. And they're not all like pieces of software either. Some of these are templates you can apply. Some of these are pieces of software or websites. And some of these are even just, you know, things that you use every day, but using them a little differently, right?
Yes. And I love that we, when we talk about these tools, we give you a couple different ways you can do it. So we're not just saying you have to use this one platform. We've given you a few different options. And so you can sort of pick and choose what works for you and for your budget.
Great. And we're going to break these down in kind of some different sections based on where you are in the process of setting up experiments. So we'll start with some things you should have in place before you even begin. We'll talk about what you need to identify what you want to test or find your experiments. We'll talk about how to capture that data and do your measurement. And then we'll talk about how to analyze it and then report it back. And we'll go and list some tools that we use every day for each one of these, as well as some alternatives.
Now, you know, you kind of alluded to it, but this is going to be a very packed information episode with a lot of information. And so don't worry about taking notes. Our show notes are going to be much more comprehensive this time. We will link to everything that we talk about. And so you can always refer back to those for the specific links and for the details.
And this is a good time to mention, if you haven't subscribed to the show notes, pop out to iterativemarketing.net/podcast, and there's an opportunity right there to subscribe to the show notes so you get them in your inbox so you don't have to worry about going and finding them later after you've listened to the podcast in your car on your commute home, and now you need to go and find the link to that one tool that Elizabeth mentioned at some point in the podcast, right?
Yep.
So before we dive into the tools you need to go and find your experiments, we should talk about some stuff you have to have in place first, right?
Yeah, and I think this is really important. You know, when we talk about experimentation, it's never an afterthought. It's something that has to be pre-planned in advance. And so before you can set up any experiment, there's specific things that need to be in place. And we're going to talk about what those specific tools are over the next few minutes.
And the first thing I think that really helps you put some structure and really have a game plan to your experiments is to have a consistent template that you use to define your experiments. So the first tool we'll talk about is the experiment template.
Yeah, and I think this is a really important tool. It's you know, we're calling it a tool, but really it's a form or a template. It can be an Excel file, a Word document. It can fit inside of whatever sort of program you're using. We use a project management software at Brilliant Metrics, and we have it plugged in there. But really what you're trying to do is you're trying to track the objective of the experiment. And this is really important because it helps to keep you on track. I can't tell you how many times we've started an experiment and then, or we've talked about an experiment and then when we get ready to implement or we get ready to, you know, share results with the client, it's like, wait, what was it we were trying to do again? And so this makes sure that everything, every piece that we're setting up, aligns with what those objectives are, what it is that we're trying to find out.
Yeah, and so it's basically a form, and you want to make sure that at a minimum you have the following several pieces of information on this form. You want to have an objective behind this experiment. What are you trying to learn? What insights out of this experiment are you going to garner? And more importantly, how will those impact the organization? Because just because you learned some fun facts about your audience doesn't mean that they're necessarily applicable. So to make sure that you have that full why documented is really important before you start testing your experiment.
That's a great point, because it's easy to test something and then get done and say, great, we learned something, but how do we use it? That's not necessarily an effective experiment. And maybe there's something else you could have been doing that would have garnered better insights that you could have applied across the organization.
You're also going to want to have a question. What are you trying to answer? And this is really where your hypothesis comes to be the second half of it. So you have a question. What are you trying to answer? What is your hypothesis? So our question is, does our audience prefer kittens or dogs? We can have a hypothesis that we believe that they like kittens over dogs, because everyone likes kittens over dogs, right?
Ooh, I might have to argue with that on that one.
Yeah. Elizabeth's a bit of a dog lover. You're also going to want to know the who behind your experiment. So your question, your hypothesis established the what. We talked about the objective, which is the why. Your who comes down to a specific audience segment, so you're going to need a blank on your form that talks about that. Usually, we try to encourage that every experiment is specific to a persona, because most of your experiments are going to be helping you refine that psychographic profile and understanding what makes your audience tick. That changes from persona to persona. So to align this with the persona really makes your experiment focused.
And then finally, measurement. And this one, I think, is another really, they're all important, but for me, the objective and the measurement are really important, because you're going to decide upfront what metrics you're using to determine your outcome. If you wait until you start getting the data back, it's easy to get blinded by the data and say, oh, well, this one element's jumping out at me. But if you go into your experiment knowing this is what I'm going to gauge my success on, it makes it that much easier. And your gut feeling, your personal feelings about it, can't really influence what the data is bringing back.
It also lets you make sure, as we'll talk about later, that you actually have those measurements set up before you start collecting data. Because if you don't, then you find out you ran your experiment for a week or two and you didn't actually have the conversion configured in analytics or whatever it is you need to know whether or not this was successful, because you didn't document and think through what success meant. What's our next tool?
Our next tool is actually something you talked about. You mentioned it was important for us to know about our audience. And so we need to, in this next tool, have a way of having some sort of documented persona or market segment. And again, this really defines the who of our experiment. And it's important because if it allows us to narrow down the audience. If we don't narrow down our audience, then we have this mass of different people that can start to counterbalance each other, counter-affect each other. And so we don't actually start getting usable data back that we're able to then apply to those personas. We need to make sure that we're honing in on one specific audience and testing with them to find out what their preference is.
Yeah. For example, I mean, if you were trying to do some tests to figure out how people felt politically in our country, right? And you just surveyed the entire country, you would have everybody who was way off on the right canceling out the opinions of everybody who was way off on the left. And at the end of the day, you would find out that the entire country is actually pretty lukewarm, which based on our current political climate is entirely wrong. So, you need to make sure that you're narrowing your audience to a particular subset that you want to learn about. And this is a great way to do that.
It's important to make sure that once you've identified what that audience is or who that persona is, keep them in front of you while you're designing your experiment. Really what you're looking to find out is what do I not know about this person, or what could I learn about this person that could help me be a smarter marketer? Mm-hmm.
The next tool, the next set of tools really comes into figuring out what to test. So you have your form filled out of what you're trying to learn, and you have your form to fill out of what you're trying to learn. You have your personas defined so that you understand the who that you're trying to test this on. Next, you need to go and figure out where are those gaps of information. And you mentioned, Elizabeth, referring back to the persona is a great place to start, but there are some other places where you're going to find that mystery pop up. And it's these mysteries that can lead to leaps in marketing effectiveness.
Yeah. And there's a number of different, tools that you can use to help figure this out. I think the first one, the first one that we jump to, the one that sort of pops into our head right away is analytics. Whether it's Google Analytics or another analytics program, it's going to help you recognize any patterns that may not make sense and allow you to identify those opportunities for testing and experimentation where you can gain some better understanding about your audience.
So obviously, if you don't have an analytics software installed on your website, go get it installed. Google Analytics is free and it's easy to set up. You're going to be looking at, primarily looking at, there's a nice little diagram in there that'll show you the flow of visitors through your site. And this will show you how people are kind of interacting page by page and moving through your website. And you can start with your landing pages and see where they go from there. You can start with the homepage and see where they go from there. And if you have your analytics set up, in some really robust ways. And I think next week's episode is actually a deep dive on analytics. We'll talk about that then. But you can even slice and dice your audience to see how certain personas are interacting with the site, which can be really powerful.
And when we're talking about interacting with the site, we're looking at engagement metrics like pages per visit, bounce rate, dwell time, scroll depth. How are people interacting with your site? How are they engaging with your content? Having an understanding here and seeing what they're doing or what they're not doing is going to open up some questions that you want answered, and that's going to lead to some experimentation ideas.
Like, why does everyone bounce off this page? Or why is everyone going to the contact us page or the about us page on who our people are? Like, what are they trying to learn? What's their goal there? And that can be fodder for some great experiments.
So Google Analytics is great for recognizing patterns, but that's just surface level. We don't understand the motivation sort of behind that, why that's happening, the human element that comes into it. And that's where our next tool comes in very handy.
Yeah. And the next tool is screen recorders. And these are really kind of creepy, cool tools. If you haven't played with one yet, definitely go play with one, because if nothing else, it's fun. But it approximates a recording of that visitor's usage of your website or app. And so it shows them where they're clicking, if they're using a desktop, where their mouse is at any given point in time, what they're entering into forms, how long they're staying on each page. And basically, it's like you're standing behind the person watching them use your site.
We use tools like Hotjar and Crazy Egg, and it lets you record the sessions of your website visitors. And we use this I cannot think of a single experiment that we've ran in the last couple of months for our clients where we haven't used one of these tools.
Yeah, it really helps you get inside the head of your audience, it's not going to produce any kind of statistically significant data. This is not a measurement tool. You're not going to be able to say whether this page works better than that page by watching screen recordings, because you'd have to watch hundreds of screen recordings, and well, we all have better things to do. But it does allow you to identify the quirks in your audience's behavior that may lead to some epiphanies on what they really want or need.
The next tool we use is heat maps, and they're similar to screen recordings in that they provide a bird's eye view of how people are interacting with the site in aggregate. So it's showing you overall, you know, what people are doing as they're interacting with your website, and provides that sort of visualization of the data.
Yeah, and here again, we're looking to recognize patterns. So everybody is clicking on this thing, or everybody seems to be hovering their mouse over this section of the page and paying a lot of attention over on this section of the page. That may mean that that content is more important to them than other content. It may also mean that that content is in a more prominent position than other content. This is a great opportunity to go in and engineer an experiment to go and figure out, was it the content or the position of the content that really intrigued our audience? And so these screen recordings tell you a lot about how people are engaging, but more from a pattern recognition standpoint than the heat maps tell you how people are engaging with your website, but more from a pattern recognition standpoint than the screen recording. Screen recordings are one at a time sort of look. A heat map is layering that information on top of each other.
And this is another one we use anytime we present experimentation findings. You know, we've got our initial slide with our findings, and then we typically back that up with a heat map recording. And I can't tell you how many times things that once we look at the heat map, we're like, of course, that makes sense, but it wasn't something that any of the other data had indicated. And so these are this is a very revealing tool.
Our next tool is user experience testing platform. This is most commonly, people just refer to the brand name of usertesting.com because it's the one that most people use. But it is a tool that lets you basically give homework to a panel of people to go and try to emulate the experience of your audience. So that could be interacting with an ad all the way through purchase. It could be just a purchase or a fact-finding mission. You can even have them go out and look at competitor sites as well. But where this comes into experimentation is it's a great opportunity to identify the places where your audience may be getting hung up in your experience.
Yeah, this is one of the tools. I love this one. I've used this in the past, and every time I have, I totally nerd out over it. I really enjoy it, and it's a little creepy maybe because you're watching the screen recording of people's actions, and you're listening to their voice recordings as they explain what it is they're doing as they move through the process. But I love this tool because one of the other things that it allows you to do is when you're selecting your audience, you can select your audience. You can specify geography, occupation, age, behavioral characteristics. And so it really gives you an opportunity to sort of build, your user case and then see how it is that they're interacting with your website.
A couple of things to note about this compared to screen recordings, because the two tools do serve slightly different purposes. Screen recordings are your actual audience. Those are your real audience, the people that you're really driving to your site. So whereas a platform like user testing is a panel of what some people have called professional testers, right? So these are people that spend a lot of time sitting there testing other people's sites. And that means that they have certain biases, and maybe they're more used to certain user interface patterns than the general public might be, because they have been doing this so often. And what they're saying into that microphone may not be representative of what your overall audience is thinking, but it's a good indicator. The other big difference is that you can generally capture a lot more information with a screen recording than you can with a user testing. So a lot of screen recordings, you can get hundreds of screen recordings. As many as you want to watch, you can capture. Whereas on a user testing, you're going to be paying a fee for every person who is sitting there and going through the motions. And that's going to be a little bit more costly per volume of data, but you're getting a lot richer information because you're getting inside that person's head. And the last thing is, user testing can extend beyond your website. You can have them start from an ad. You can have them start from a Google search or wherever you want them to start and end up wherever you want them to end up, and even hit competitor sites in the process. Whereas screen recordings are limited to your website or app, only what you control that you can actually record from.
So have you ever gone in and participated as a tester in user testing?
I have not. I automatically assume that I'm biased enough that they don't want my feedback.
They don't. Yeah, I signed up and you know, indicated I was a marketer, and they didn't want to talk to me. So apparently we have too strong of opinions about websites.
Yeah. So what's our next tool?
So our next tool is a Tickler file. And really, you know, this is not a formal, you know, tool that you can go out there and necessarily purchase. It's really just an internal document, a place to store experiment ideas. And it can be a Word file, Excel, whatever internal document works for your organization. And really what you're looking to do is just keep an idea of potential future experiments.
Yeah, there's a limit on how many experiments you can run concurrently. Really, you know, you can't test more than one thing with one given audience at any given time. So if you're running an experiment, it's a really bad time to come up with an awesome idea for your next experiment unless you have a place to write it down. And so this becomes that place. It's a central repository for your team, and everybody on the team can come up with experiment ideas and jot them into this file. And then when it's time to go and run your next experiment, you know exactly what your best idea is, mm-hmm. because it's all in one place.
And it's important because to really maximize your return on these experiments, you want to keep them running continuously. So from when one experiment ends to when you want to start the next one, that's a very limited window. And you would be amazed at how you had all these ideas and suddenly when it's time to implement an experiment, you can't remember what any of them were. That's happened to us on more than one occasion, which is what led to our creation of our Tickler file. And so it comes in very handy. And not only that, but it allows you to take a look at all those past ideas and sort of, you know, figure out which of those insights, potential insights, is going to be most beneficial to you based on where you are at that specific point in time.
Yep. What's our last tool when it comes to experiment planning?
Very important tool. It is our sample size calculator. And this is very important to use because it's going to tell you if your test is going to be realistic. We've talked about this before in previous episodes. You have to have a minimum sample size or you're not going to get statistically significant data back. And so by using the sample size calculator before you even start your experiment, you're able to determine if you have a large enough audience, enough traffic to be able to set up an effective experiment. And it will keep you from wasting time on an experiment that's not going to have any results for you.
Yep. And there's a great one out there. If you Google Optimizely sample size calculator, you can go grab it. Otherwise, of course, we'll link to it in the show notes. But it's an easy to use tool. You just say, you know, what percentage of change you need to realize in order to make this an effective test. And it'll tell you how many people you need to test. And you can say, yeah, no, we don't have that many people. I think this is a great point for us to take a quick break. So let's go help some people.
Before we continue, I'd like to take a quick moment to ask you iterative marketers a small but meaningful favor and ask that you give a few dollars to a charity that's important to one of our own. This week, we are asking that you make a donation to MAP International. MAP International provides medicines, prevents diseases, and promotes health in some of the world's poorest communities, while also providing humanitarian assistance and relief aid to people who are without access to shelter or basic services after disasters. To learn more, visit map.org or visit the link in the show notes. If you would like to submit your cause for consideration for our next podcast, please visit iterativemarketing.net/podcast and click the Share a Cause button. We love sharing causes that are important to you.
And we're back. Before the break, we talked about what you needed to have in place from a tool standpoint in order to be able to plan and document effective experiments and identify ideas for experiments and record them. Now we're going to get into the nuts and bolts of the tools you need to use to capture that, the data that you need to analyze, as well as analyze that data, and then finally communicate your results back out, because otherwise you just get smarter and the rest of your team doesn't, and that's no fun.
So first, let's take a look at the tools that can help us gather the data to support our conclusion to our hypothesis.
Yeah, and the 800-pound gorilla here is Google Analytics. I mean, that really is the backbone of your data collection, because it allows us to aggregate data over time and from a variety of sources. Basically, any interaction with your website, it can pull that together in a way that becomes easy for analysis and action.
Yeah, it helps us to measure the impact of efforts in ways that other tools that we've discussed can't. It's quantitative, so we're able to set it up to measure our KPIs the KPIs that we identified when we were setting up our experiment. It lets us handle large volumes of data that we wouldn't be able to necessarily manage in an efficient way if we were just, you know, compiling this on our own and using spreadsheets. And then it lets us slice our data by a number of different factors, whether it's time period, traffic source, any sort of dimension that we want.
But in order for Google Analytics to really work for you, you have to set it up correctly. Now, next week, we're going to go and do a deep dive into analytics and everything you need to do to get this this workhorse really working for you. But I want to leave our audience with something this episode. So there are really three biggest, I guess, oversights that we see in Google Analytics setups that really sabotage your ability to collect data. And those are not having effective URL tagging in place, not having conversion tracking in place, and then not having data cleanliness filters set up on the data coming into analytics. We should talk about each one of those very briefly. Again, deep dive next week. So if this seems like we're leaving something on the table, we are, because if we talked about this to the depth that I really want to, we'll be here all afternoon.
Yes. So let's start off with good URL tagging. We need to pass information into Google Analytics about where our traffic's coming from and what we know about that traffic. And the way that we do that is through making sure that those URLs are tagged and correctly coming into and being disseminated out through Google Analytics the way that we intended them to be.
And basic rule here is every single link that you publish to your website should have a tag on it of some sort. And again, next week, we'll get into the details of how to do it. But if you're not tagging your traffic, then you're missing a big chunk of the data that you need in order to analyze the success of your experiment.
The next one is conversion tracking. So for us to be able to effectively measure our results, we need to set up conversions and analytics. And again, these directly tie to the measurement objectives we outlined in our initial document. It ties to our KPIs, and it allows us to measure both leading indicators like case study downloads or add to cart clicks, as well as trailing indicators like actual sales and revenue.
And then the final thing that you need to make sure that you have set up in order to get analytics working for you are data cleanliness filters. Unfortunately, your target audience isn't the only one interacting with your website. You have humans in the form of testers. You have your own team interacting as they edit pages or go and test things. You have bots that are out on the internet going and scanning web pages. All of these can totally hose your data. And so you want to make sure that you set up some basic filters in order to keep that data clean.
And making sure you've got those going consistently. We just had a client a few weeks ago who reached out to us and they said, we've got this huge spike in traffic. We're so excited. And when we went in and took a look, they had some bot traffic coming in that when we took it out, they're like, oh, never mind. And then they had to go back and explain to the higher ups who they had reported this great traffic to that it wasn't real traffic after all.
And this can totally skew an A-B test, too, because it's not guaranteed that your non-real traffic is going to only come in on version A or version B. So it's important that you get it cleaned up. Speaking of A-B tests, one of the other tools that you can use to effectively gather information is an A-B testing tool for your website. And this is something like Optimizely or Convert.com or Google Experiments.
A good A-B test is imperative to optimizing your landing pages and figuring out what words and what images are moving your audience, either in mind or in specific action.
Good examples of things that you can test with an A-B testing tool are things like headlines, calls to action, visual cues, or even just the order or placement of content and knowing which messages need to come first.
Really, the gold standard when we talk about A-B testing for the web is Optimizely. It lets you set one piece of code on your website or web page, and then you work within that tool to set up all of your experiments. It's really nice because you get to use a WYSIWYG, what you see is what you get, editor to create your alternate version. And so you don't necessarily need to have someone that knows how to code. It can be anyone who has, you know, the ability to use a WYSIWYG can set up your different experiments for you, which is nice because it cuts back on that development time and allows your team to manage this rather than having to go to an outside resource.
And then right within the tool, you know, you take the web page, you create your version B, and then you say what percentage of your audience is going to get version B instead of version A. And then it takes care of swapping that out live as people hit your website. It also makes sure that anybody who got version B the first time is going to continue to get version B every time they come back, which is really key to an effective test because you don't want to find out that because they saw both of them, they converted particularly well. And this is why it's really important to use one of these tools.
Not only that, the tool is going to report back on your results. And not only that, but it's actually going to tell you if which of your results were statistically significant. So you don't even have to take that extra step to go out and determine if the results you got back are valid or not.
Optimizely is certainly one of the better and more common tools out there. There are others. One that we found that works really well and is slightly less expensive is a tool called convert.com. That's worked really well for us. But you don't necessarily need to have any budget either. There's a free tool out there called Google Experiments that Google offers along with its million of other free tools. It does have some drawbacks though.
The downsides are that it's not quite as easy to use as some of the other tools we've talked about, Optimizely and Convert. And you either have to redirect version B to another page or you have to have a developer write code to support your experiment. So there's pros and cons to each of the systems. It's really about finding out what works best for you and your team.
Yeah. So we talked about A/B testing on the web, but what about email? What's the tool for that?
So this one's kind of easy because pretty much every email tool out there has an A/B tester built into it. And you really want to, what you're looking for to get out of this A/B tester is you want to make sure that it guarantees a random sample and you want to make sure that you're able to send both versions at the same time.
Yeah, so I've seen marketers try to, you know, execute version A of an email one day and version B of an email another day, or try to compare two different versions of an email or two different sends of an email. Really, that's not the way to run an experiment via email. You want to use the built-in A/B testing tool. That's why it's there, and it's the only way to guarantee that random sample. It's the only way to guarantee that everything, you know, it controls for all the other variables and everything else is equal, essentially.
And again, this is built into pretty much every email platform out there, so you know, you don't have to go and search for a special tool.
Mm-hmm. The next up is A/B testing for your ads. And this gets a little bit tricky, but if you're testing two different versions of a display ad, there's sort of a right way to do this and a wrong way to do this. And the right way involves making sure, just like we talked about, Optimizely and Convert are going to make sure that the same person who gets version B of your web page the first time is going to always get version B when they come back. We want to do the same thing with our display and video ads. The trick to doing this is having an ad server technology serving up those ads, because then that ad server can make sure that if I give Elizabeth version B of the ad, Elizabeth always gets version B of the ad, regardless of where on the web she happens to be having that opportunity to see the ad. There's no other way to do this, and you have to have that ad server in place to do it.
If you don't have access to a third party ad server such as Atlas or DoubleClick Campaign Manager, then you'll want to work with an analytics firm such as Brilliant Metrics, yours truly, to help you get this set up.
And I think it's important to note that this is true for display and video ads, but when we start getting into social advertising, it gets a little bit trickier and the tools don't actually support really great A/B tests. I think it'd be worthwhile probably having an entire episode on how to run an effective A/B test and really get into the weeds on that, because there's certain things you have to do to kind of compensate for the fact that the social tools well suck for this, basically.
It's very true. I'm actually going to make a note here because I think that's a great idea for an episode.
Excellent. So we talked about testing things on the website. We talked about testing things in email. We talked about testing things in ads. But sometimes we can't really test this with the actual advertising and marketing that we're doing. Sometimes the information we need kind of goes one level beyond that and into the thoughts and hearts of our audience, right?
Yeah. And when we want to know how people are feeling or what they already know about our brand or our product or our service, the best way to get that information, to gather that data, is through a survey.
So if you're going to run a survey, now you have the challenge of who are you going to survey? And you really have two options here. You can generate your own panel of respondents to your survey, either through your own customer base or prospect lists or email database or whoever. Or you can go out and buy that panel of respondents. And there are pros and cons to both approaches.
If you are going to be surveying your own respondents, your own database, there are some great tools. SurveyMonkey is probably one of the most popular ones. We really like using SurveyGizmo. And then another alternative is Google Surveys as well.
Mm-hmm. If you want to go pay for a panel, then you can use a company like Cervata. In even some of the more less expensive do-it-yourself tools have access to panels as well. So like, I know SurveyMonkey has their SurveyMonkey audience tool as well, but generally paying a premium company that has the ability to go and pull together exactly the panel you want can work out to get you better results.
A quick note, if you do go the Google Survey route, while it is a free tool that you can use, it's a hybrid between a survey tool and a pop-up polling tool. And while it gives you a huge panel to work with, it has some serious limitations in terms of the number of questions that you're able to ask at a time and how narrowly you can target your audience.
So you want to go and take a look at what are you trying to learn? What sort of audience do you need to learn this information? How exact does that audience need to match up? And then what do you need the tool to be able to do as far as presenting questions? And if they answer this, then we need to ask these follow-up questions, et cetera. And then start flipping through the platforms, because every platform gives you a different opportunity when it comes to how you can organize questions, how you can organize your panel, where you can get it from. And to cover that in this episode would be way too long.
So an alternative to a survey, if that doesn't really fit your needs, something else you can consider is a website poll. And here we're talking about something like Hotjar, or again, Google Surveys has the ability to do polls. With that in mind, you're sort of facing two different hurdles. First, you need to have a lot of website visitors. And not only a lot of website visitors, but a lot of website visitors that are willing to answer your poll so that you get statistically significant data. The second hurdle that you're up against is that you're limited to asking one question, and it has to be easy to answer or you're not going to get enough data. I've seen countless clients that have, and not just clients, but websites that we've visited where, and I'm sure you've seen them too, the pop-up box shows up and it's this question that is not simple for you to ask, and it's just not worth your time, so you close it out and you ignore it.
But for some brands, if you have a website that has a massive amount of traffic and you need an answer to a question and you don't want to try and put together a survey with a bunch of email addresses, this can be a great way to get an answer to a simple question answered by your exact audience in relatively short period of time.
So that's a pretty extensive list for gathering the data. Now that we have the data, how do we analyze it?
And again, we're going to talk about our good friend here, Google Analytics, which seems to play a starring role in every single chapter of this book here. But Google Analytics can be a great way for doing some quick analysis of your data. It will help you visualize and do that ad hoc reporting quickly to see what's going on behind that data.
If you're getting the data through custom dimensions, which I'm assuming we're going to talk about next week, then you really have you can report in some very robust ways.
Yeah. And can you do this reporting without an analytics tool? Yeah. I mean, certainly if you're working within surveys or some other offline data capture methods, yes. But if you're looking at trying to measure the effectiveness of any digital marketing, really, you're going to want to use analytics to start that analysis certainly capture that data and start that analysis for you.
Now, I know we've skimmed over Google Analytics, even though we've mentioned it multiple times, but again, we're going to cover this next week in episode 41. So definitely tune back in and get the full story on that.
Sometimes analytics isn't enough, though. Sometimes you can't get the actual comparison of A and B in one tool because you're pulling data from offline sales data, you're pulling data from your ad platforms, your marketing automation platform, or somewhere else. And in that case, you're going to want to be able to combine that data. And for experiment analysis, really a tool like Excel or Google Sheets is generally enough, because you don't need that really robust data visualization and analysis capabilities of a more expensive tool like a Tableau if you're just trying to figure out if version A or version B was more effective.
To really make this an effective tool for you to be able to combine this data and then slice and dice it how you need it, you need to have a strong understanding of Excel or Google Sheets, and more importantly, pivot tables. And what you like to say, Steve, is pivot tables are your friend.
Yeah, they're
not my friend, but they're your friend, and I appreciate the data that you're able to get out of them.
And even you, Elizabeth, they're not as scary as they seem. Once you get your head around it, it's like why was I intimidated by this? I mean, I can't tell you the number of people that I've worked with and coached over the years that have been like, this isn't scary. Let's go through it. And then like, oh, yeah, that's not a big deal. So please.
No, it's not.
Learn pivot tables. They're not that big of a deal. Once you get your head around the basic concept, it's like, it's easy.
Well, and the other thing to keep in mind too is if you're reporting on you know, you're looking at the same data every month, you're able to plug that information into this already built pivot table and apply it. And then you have very easy access to be able to dice and splice that data the way that you need to.
Once you've aggregated the data and you've started your analysis and you say, oh yeah, A definitely won. Well, hold your horses before you start going and shouting from the rooftops at A1, because the next step, the next tool you need is a confidence calculator.
Yep. And this is important because just because we have a winner doesn't necessarily mean that we have a result. And we talked about this in depth in episode 7. And you'll want to make sure that you're using an A-B confidence calculator to determine if your results are statistically significant. And we will link to the one that we developed and shared out with you guys. We'll link to that in the show notes.
Now, there's a new kid when it comes to data analysis and visualization, and that is Google Data Studio. And I must apologize to an audience. It is on my list of things to dive into and really do a deep dive, and I'll probably have a blog post for it here shortly, but I have really only touched the surface of this tool, and from what I can tell, it looks really cool. It allows you to pull data from multiple sources and aggregate it, kind of like Excel, you know, is the manual way of doing that. And it has the gorgeous visualizations to kind of jumping ahead into tools to communication. You can create some really pretty graphs out of this tool right there. So, again, stay tuned. We're going to talk about Google Data Studio again in the future, I'm sure. But, if you want to jump in and explore that tool, it looks really promising. It's still in beta, so I'm not too late.
So finally, getting to our last topic, and thank you so much for sticking around. I think this has turned into our longest podcast yet. But tools for communication, and this is so important because you've done all the work up to now. You've set these up correctly. You've found an experiment that's going to give you insights. You've measured it. You've analyzed it. And that's great. But now you need to do something with that data. And as Steve said earlier, if you just keep it to yourself or you keep it within your team, you're not realizing the true benefit of what your experiment has revealed.
Yeah. The first tool is graphs. I mean, if you can make your results graphical, that is really, really important because a number is not, it's not visual. It's not something that everybody can just understand. And so it's really important to make your results as graphical as possible.
Graphs are easy. They can be generated from analytics, Excel, or from Google Sheets. And another thing that you can look into is if you've got access to a dashboarding platform, this can be a great asset, but it only works after you figured out what those KPIs are, what KPIs matter to you on an ongoing basis. Otherwise, you're going to want to use more of an ad hoc tool like Excel.
Mm-hmm. The next tool is your experiment log. Just like you want to log your experiment on the way in, you want to log your results and your insights on the way out and keep a running list of exactly what you've learned by audience segment so that you can refer back to it later. Either basically because you want to be intentional if you're rerunning an experiment basically, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you want to have a strong understanding of what insights you've already gathered. And so you want to make sure that log is looking at the experiment by your audience or your persona. And one thing to keep in mind here is that just because you ran your experiment with one audience doesn't mean that you can't use that again with another audience. In fact, you should use it with another audience. It's going to help you to figure out where those lines between the two audiences lie. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of where lines lie between audiences, the last tool in this entire marathon podcast that we're going to talk about is your persona document, which we introduced at the very beginning, but becomes important again on the tail end.
Yeah. You know, we've talked about this in persona ones before. I've said this a few times. I feel like a broken record, so I apologize. But a persona document it's a living document. It's not something you create and leave alone. And the best way to be able to update that, the most informed way to update that is through your experiments. And so you really want to take a look at what insights you learned. And did you learn something about that audience? And if so, does it apply to the persona that you developed? Does it apply to the customer journey that you put together? You want to make sure that you update that information in the persona and close that loop. And then not only that, but you want to make sure you share that with your team. Share that with anyone who's using these documents. Is your sales team using this? Is this you know, language that's being used throughout the organization. If your entire management team is referring to your persona of Ethan, then you want to make sure that they all know that we learned that Ethan is not a fan of LinkedIn, doesn't want anything to do with it, but he loves Facebook.
We covered a ton of ground in this episode. Normally we throw a little summary at the end. I don't even know where we would start with a summary on this episode. So I just want to, again, invite all of you, take a look at the show notes. We've got links to the tools. We've got a lot more detail there. And if you aren't getting the show notes in your email, go out and subscribe, because it's certainly on this episode, there's a ton of value there. I also want to thank everyone for making time for us this week, more time than usual. And until next week, onward and upward.
If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to the podcast on YouTube or your favorite podcast directory. If you want notes and links to resources discussed on the show, sign up to get them emailed to you each week at iterativemarketing.net. There, you'll also find the Iterative Marketing blog and our community LinkedIn group, where you can share ideas and ask questions of your fellow iterative marketers. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our username is at @ITER8IVE. Or email us at podcast@iterativemarketing.net. The Iterative Marketing Podcast is a production of Brilliant Metrics, a consultancy helping brands and agencies rid the world of marketing waste. Our producer is Heather Ullman, with transcription assistance from Emily Bechtel. Our music is by Seastock Audio Music Production and Sound Design. You can check them out at seastockaudio.com. We'll see you next week. Until then, onward and upward.